This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Mark. Now here's Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Mark chapter 14 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Kisses come in a multitude of varieties. They're all different kinds of kisses. There's the forehead kiss, the Eskimo kiss, the hand kiss, of course, the cheek kiss. There's the goodnight kiss, the hello kiss. Then there's that cold kiss. Of course, the lingering kiss, even the holy kiss. But there is at least one other type of kiss, for in tonight's passage, we find the original Judas kiss. It's been said, a kiss is a contraction of the mouth due to an enlargement of the heart. That might be true of most kisses, but not the kiss that we'll talk about tonight. Some kisses can be feigned. Jealousy, anger, hatred can hide behind a kiss. A kiss can mask our hypocrisy. Such was the kiss that Jesus received in the Garden of Gethsemane. In Oriental culture, a kiss is like a handshake. It's a token of friendship. But Judas's kiss turned out to be a kiss of betrayal and death. With a kiss, Judas turned Jesus over to his enemies. And it all took place in a garden called Gethsemane. That's where Jesus took his disciples after they had celebrated Passover, sang their hymn, and exited the upper room. As they walked out into the night, a conversation ensued. We pick it up in verse 27. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.'" Where is it written? In Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. This will be a crushing night for Jesus' disciples. Jesus will be crucified, and they all will stumble and forsake him. He says, "But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." Boy, you see Peter's pride, his self-assurance. Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." Peter was proud. Peter was cocky. And what did Jesus promise a cocky Peter? Before the cock crowed, before the rooster crowed twice, Peter will deny Jesus three times. Notice Peter's boast. "Even if all are made to stumble, yet I will not be." He compares himself with the other disciples. "Even if the others wimp out, Lord, I'll stand strong. I won't cave in. You can count on me." Beware of spiritual pride, of putting confidence in the flesh, of believing in ourselves and in our abilities. My faith is not in my ability to stand, but in God's ability to prop me up. That's where our faith should be. At crunch time, in essence, when the rooster crows, we all tend to act like chickens. That's why we need to stand strong in the Lord, not in our own strength. Peter's going to learn. But he spoke more vehemently, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said likewise. All the disciples were so sure of themselves. Peter particularly was devastated when he heard, for the second time. Jumping ahead, verse 72 tells us, when he thought about it, he wept. That's what will happen to him this night. Well, then they came to a place which was named Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Now, Gethsemane means oil press. Gethsemane was an olive grove, and it had a press that would squeeze the oil out of the olives. And it was near this press that Jesus felt incredible spiritual pressure. His soul and his spirit were crushed, literally squeezed. You know, it's interesting. In Genesis chapter 3, we're told that sin and the rule of Satan began in a garden called Eden. In Revelation chapter 22, we discover that when Jesus returns and puts an end to sin and Satan's revolt, he'll remake the earth into a beautiful garden. The story of mankind both begins and ends in a garden. And it's interesting that the turning point between the beginning and the end occurs in another garden, a garden called Gethsemane. For it was in this garden that the battle was fought and won that would end up wrestling the world from Satan's clutches and delivering it over into the hands of God. Gethsemane was the garden of decision. For it's here that Jesus overcame his pain and his hurt and his betrayal and his struggle and readied himself for the cross the next day. In the garden of Gethsemane, the Father took away Jesus' cup of pain, the pain of his rejection, and replaced it with his peace. The battle was not just won on the cross, but the night before. Gethsemane was Jesus' crunch time. And he took Peter, James, and John with him, and he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch." He went a little farther and fell on the ground. Jesus' legs buckled. His body toppled to his knees. Jesus is carrying a heavy weight now. Luke tells us beads of perspiration streamed down Jesus' face. They had the consistency and appearance of large drops of blood. Jesus was in inexplicable agony. As Matthew said, he was exceedingly sorrowful and deeply distressed. And his prayers were not uttered in soft whispers. For according to Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears. You know, it's interesting to me that the master of every situation obviously lost control of his emotions. Jesus cries, and he cries loudly. His soul is being pressed. It's being squeezed. Paradise was lost when Adam sinned in a garden. Now in this garden, Jesus is submitting to God. Obedience is gelling in his heart. Hebrews tells us that in Gethsemane, Jesus learned obedience. See, in the garden, Jesus learned how to press on even while being pressed. How to continue forward even when you feel like giving up. How to obey even when you want to abort. How to make hard choices that have painful results. Jesus learned obedience in the Garden of Gethsemane. He experienced it for himself. In verse 35, Jesus prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." What went on in Gethsemane defies our logic and our understanding. I believe this is a deep and a holy mystery. Some folks believe that Jesus was trying to avoid the cross, that he was asking God to save the world another way. After he'd asked three times and it was apparent that the cross was inevitable, he ceased from his prayer. That's how some people interpret it. But I don't think that's what happened at all. Jesus was born to die. Remember, the wise men brought him myrrh, an embalming fluid. Revelation 13, verse 8, referred to Jesus as the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. According to John 17, verse 1, the cross was Jesus' moment of glory. It's what he had entered the world to accomplish. It was the moment he had looked forward to. It was the ultimate aim of his mission. Not an experience he was trying to escape or avoid. I don't believe that death was in the cup that Jesus prayed would pass from him. I believe that that cup held the pain and poison of his rejection. Jesus had watched one of his most beloved disciples walk out the door. Judas had stabbed him in the back. Jesus knew all the disciples would stumble and fail him that night. He'd even predicted Peter's awful denial. The rooster was clearing his throat as Jesus prayed. Here were Jesus' choice men, his sidekicks in whom he had invested, the treasures of his kingdom. Yet now, in his hour of need, they have abandoned him. Even as he agonizes in the garden, they're oblivious to his travail. Jesus cries out to God. He slugs it out with demons, if you will, while the disciples snooze. See, I believe the devil wanted Jesus to drink the cup that he mentions here and succumb to his feelings of rejection. Stop loving them. Stop giving. Stop sacrificing. Abort your mission. Satan whispers to Jesus, it's time for you to take care of yourself. I believe that's what was going on. How do you love friends who act like foes? How do you die for people who deny you? See, Jesus was willing to hurt all the way to heaven if necessary, but he wanted the Father to remove his pain, to take this cup of rejection from him. And I believe the Father did just that, that his feelings of rejection were replaced with an incredible peace. You know, in a lesser sense, we all pass through a Gethsemane. We all have similar experiences. How many of you have been betrayed by a friend or gone through a painful divorce? Or were terminated from a job? If you ask him, Jesus will remove your cup of hurt and replace it with his peace. But God also wants us to learn obedience, to do things God's way, even when life doesn't go our way. Jesus obeyed even when it hurt. What about you? Have you learned obedience? Well, then he came and found them sleeping. And Jesus said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. For the spirit truly is willing, but the flesh is weak. Oh, how we're all painfully and embarrassingly aware of that truth, the truth of that statement. How often have we knelt to pray and to seek God only to fall asleep? I have. Jesus sums up the disciples' dilemma in 10 words. The spirit truly is willing, but the flesh is weak. My spirit has been redeemed. I have a love for God and a love for others that God has given to me. And in doing God's will, you know, I rejoice in the goodness that he's brought to my life. My spirit is alive. The spirit is willing. But the difficulty becomes, my spirit requires the cooperation of my flesh in order to obey. And that's where my problems lie, in the flesh. For I have a lazy body and contrary habits and corrupt thoughts and a negative outlook at times. The spirit is willing, but there's a part of me that's as weak as water, the flesh. And that's why at crunch time, you and I, like Jesus, we need to rely on the Father's strength, not our own. Well, verse 39, again, Jesus went away and prayed and spoke the same words. And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy and they did not know what to answer him. Then he came the third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. Usually we say 3 strikes and you're out. But aren't you glad that's not what Jesus said to his disciples? Well, Jesus will give them a second chance. He is the Lord of grace and mercy. He is the God of another chance. Jesus concludes, though, the hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise up, let us go. See, my betrayer is at hand. And immediately while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Jesus had just risen from his knees. His agony was over. The cup of rejection and hurt that had been so heavy had now been removed. There's now a peace in Jesus' heart, a resolve in his mind. His nerves are steel. His will is set. Love for humanity and the Father's glory are his motivations. On his knees in the garden, Jesus prayed and he won the victory that will be played out before the priests and in Pilate's judgment hall and on Calvary's cross. But no sooner does Jesus rise from his knees than an angry mob appears with burning torches and angry voices. It's made up of temple guards with billy clubs and Jewish dignitaries in priestly robes. In front of the pack is a familiar face. Psalm 41, verse 9 is prophetic. It quotes Messiah in advance. Even my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. The prophecy was speaking of Judas. Judas Iscariot followed Jesus for 3 years, but now he leads him to his execution. Now his betrayer had given them a signal saying, "Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Take him and lead him away safely." Now remember, chapters 14, the first two verses, the Jews were looking for a way to arrest Jesus without starting a riot. And Judas was their answer. Judas knew where Jesus would be spending the night. Judas could identify Jesus. The Jews would arrest Jesus under the cover of darkness. He'd be in Roman custody by daybreak. By mid-morning, Jesus would be crucified. All without the gaze of the common folk who had followed him. I've often wondered, though, why did the Jews hire Judas? Why did they need Judas? Surely there were men in their own ranks who could have picked Jesus out of a crowd. I mean, it would have saved them 30 pieces of silver. Jews care about that. And why did Judas choose to identify Jesus with a kiss of all things? A kiss. A kiss in any culture is a symbol of affection or friendship. I've concluded that Judas's kiss was part of Satan's strategy to keep Jesus off the cross. You know, that's what he wanted. To keep him off the cross. For a kiss, the kiss of a friend is a kiss from a friend, a betrayal kiss from a friend is a dagger in your back. I mean, it's an attack on your heart. Satan wanted to pry Jesus off the cross by nursing this hurt and this resentment. Satan, in essence, was saying, forget the cross. Why die for people who've betrayed you and deny you, even with a kiss? The good news is that Satan's attempts were fruitless. Jesus won the battle in the garden. He prayed for the Father to take the cup of rejection from him, and the Father did. So, as soon as Judas had come, immediately he went up to him and said to him, "Rabbi, Rabbi," and kissed him. Then they laid their hands on him and took him. And one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Now an impulsive disciple reacted to the arrest. He drew his sword on one of the guards. I'm sure he went for his head. He wanted to split his skull in half. But at the last second, the guard ducked and the sword clipped off his ear. Luke 22 verse 51 tells us that Jesus picked off the lopped off lobe and reattached it to the man's head. A miracle of mercy. Jesus heals even his arresting officer. How's that for love? Now, it's interesting. The last miracle that Jesus worked while on earth has had to be repeated countless times since. Think this through. He heals a wound inflicted by one of his followers. It's sad, but a free-swinging saint with a sharp sword can do much harm. Hebrews refers to the Bible as a two-edged sword. That means that a person motivated by anger or jealousy or revenge can take even the life-giving word of God and use it to cut up another person. This is why Ephesians 6 calls the Bible the sword of the Spirit. See, our use of Scripture has to be guided by the Spirit, not by our ignorance or by our desire to win an argument or our need for revenge on someone else. No, our use of the Scripture must be guided by the Spirit of God, lest we hurt each other using even the word, the sword of God. Notice specifically, Jesus reattaches a dismembered body part. It's tragic but true. Even well-meaning servants of the Lord can hurt people that they want to help. We can lose patience. We can misrepresent Jesus. We can lash out rather than love. Even in church work, folks get hurt inadvertently. They leave the church. They get lopped off from the body. At times, ears are flying everywhere. This is why I'm so thankful that Jesus still reattaches lopped off body parts. I know folks who've been wounded by an angry pastor, maybe a misguided saint, and they become disillusioned with church, but Jesus still works miracles. He can heal and reattach people to his body. Remember, Mark's gospel was probably Peter's account. You remember Mark was Peter's protege. The early church believed that Mark's gospel was Peter's memoirs. This might explain why Mark doesn't identify this sword swinger. For according to John, the brother with the blade was Peter. Could be that an embarrassed Peter chose to skip over that detail in the version that he provided Mark. Well, after cleaning up Peter's mess, Jesus addresses the mob. Verse 48. Then Jesus answered and said to them, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you did not take me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." I love Jesus' explanation here. Jesus wasn't maneuvering behind the scenes. He had been open and honest and public about his intentions. It was the Jews hiding under a rock, sneaking around. Their nighttime lynching party here was proof. Verse 50 describes the disciples' reaction to this Judas-led mob. Then they all forsook him and fled. Imagine this. The men who had been mentored by Jesus for 3.5 years said thank you to him by disappearing in the darkness. These brave disciples all tucked tail and ran. And remember their bold claims earlier that night? When Peter promised Jesus in verse 31, "If I have to die with you, I will not deny you." We're told they all said likewise. Hey, if you've ever been tempted to put confidence in your flesh, in your own resolve, and boast in your efforts and your determination, remember verse 50. They all forsook him and fled. The disciples boasted that they would never deny Jesus and saw no reason to pray, while Jesus, the perfect man, cried out to his Father for strength in time of need. Little wonder the disciples fold under pressure while Jesus holds it together. See, Peter and the other disciples are the classic example of what happens when you put your trust in your own strength. Jesus instead was trusting in God. Yeah, I like how one man described his dependence on God. He said, "He had the strength and I had the weakness, so we teamed up. It was an unbeatable combination." We need to remember that. Now, a certain young man followed him, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body. And the young men laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. I suppose you could say this young man barely escaped. Just barely escaped. Most commentators suggest that this certain young man was the author of the gospel, Mark himself. Remember, tradition says that the Last Supper was held at Mark's house. When the disciples left, Mark must have thrown a linen sheet around him and went after them and followed them to the garden. The point Mark is making here is that Jesus was left absolutely alone. The disciples had left. Now Mark leaves. The weight of our sin, the burden of the cross, came down on Jesus and on him alone. Verse 53, "And they led Jesus away to the high priest." Now, the high priest at the time was a man named Caiaphas. And when we piece together all four gospel accounts, we discover that Jesus was actually tried 5 times this night. First, John 18, verse 13 tells us that he was taken initially to Annas, who was the former high priest. Second, he was tried by Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. Third, once Jesus was condemned by the Jews, he was taken to the fortress of Antonio, the military headquarters of the Roman procurator at the time, Pontius Pilate. In the hands of the Romans, Jesus becomes a political hot potato. At first, Pilate wants to pass the buck, and upon hearing that Jesus is from Galilee, he shuffles him off to King Herod. Herod tries Jesus for a fourth time, but King Herod refuses to rule on the case, and he sends Jesus immediately back to Pilate for his 5th trial.
Thanks for joining us today on Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. The program you're hearing comes to you from Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently working his way through the Gospel of Mark. If you take a closer look at this book, you notice that Jesus is continually on the move. His ministry has begun, and he's not wasting any time. On the other hand, he's never in a hurry enough to keep him from healing someone or to talk to those who want to hear. May his example be something you keep track of as you go about your days. Are you too busy to stop and notice that person at the grocery store who is crying? Are you in so much of a hurry that you're not willing to sit and talk with your teenager when she's showing a willingness to go there? Take Jesus' ways of being intentional, moved to action, but caring for those you come in contact with. If you have any questions about today's message or about who Jesus is, we'd love to connect with you. Our number is 770-736-2828. If you have prayer requests or simply need to talk with someone, just call 770-736-2828. You can also find more information about who we are and what we believe on our website, sandyadams.org. This has been Sandy Adams Radio.